Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and we've got our money ladies back today, Rana Farooqar and Michelle Singletary. Hey, ladies.
Hey,
hello.
Meghna.
For the few On Point listeners out there who don't know who the money ladies are, let me remove yourself from that state of ignorance. Rana Farooqar is a global business columnist and associate editor at the Financial Times, also with CNN as well, and author of Don't Be Evil and Makers and Takers. Hello, Rana. There's your official hello. Michelle Singletary is a nationally syndicated personal finance columnist at the Washington Post and author most recently of What to Do with Your Money When Crisis Hits. This is your official hello, Michelle. And really, they're known as the On Point Money Ladies. Now, let's listen up here, because what we're going to talk about today is that right now, more and more, in fact, millions of American workers, they've got two words for their employers. I quit.
Hi, my name is Amanda Charney, and I live in Los Angeles, California. I saw the question about if you quit your job recently. I actually was really surprised to find out that I'm not alone.
Yes, I quit my job.
I'm calling because I am one of those people.
My name is Joe Frederick. I'm calling from Buffalo, New York. When I left my job, I got a new job right away, and I lost like 10 years worth of accumulated raises. The sad part about that is the amount of raises that I'd had over the course of 10 years was so low that it wasn't even a factor in considering the move.
Hey there, my name is Carrie Nguyen, calling in from Las Vegas, Nevada. Through pandemic, I started a business. I poured into that while we were closed, and it ended up paying me what I used to earn pre-pandemic and then some.
Hi, my name is Joshua Langtree, and I'm calling from Saco, Maine. Having grown up during the financial crisis of 2008, I've never seen a job market like this, and I want to hop on it right now because I don't think it'll last forever.
Well, in April alone, nearly 4 million Americans quit their jobs. By the end of May, there were 9.21 million open jobs in this country, the highest since the Bureau of Labor Statistics started tracking that data point in 2000. So this is what we're going to talk about today. What is going on? What's driving employees out the door right now? Michelle, you get the first crack at this. What's happening?
Well, you know, I think what happened with the pandemic, especially in the service industry, many people realize I don't like this job. I'm not really making a lot of money, and I'm, you know, in jeopardy of possibly contracting COVID. And with so much competition, even if they wanted to stay in a similar job, they can, you know, look elsewhere for employers who are paying more. I mean, my son, for example, just graduated from college. He's looking for a permanent position. He applied for two jobs, and one was paying him minimum wage. And he was like, forget that. And so he's going to go be a lifeguard, which is paying considerably more than a position where he'd be a cashier at a supermarket. Because, you know, his mama said, you got to get a job while you're looking for the real job. You're not sitting around here, dude. But I think that was a real good example of what people are doing. And he's like, you know, listen, I'm going for the job that's going to pay me more. Even though that job may not guarantee him the hours that the other one was, but he's pretty confident that he can get the hours. And I think that's it. I applaud those folks who called in and who are saying, I am worth more. And this market is showing me that.
Yeah. Well, you know, Rana, at first glance, it seems like retail is a particularly important epicenter for this. I'm seeing 650,000 workers in retail alone quit their jobs in April. But it's also going on well beyond that sector.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And, you know, there's big structural things in play here that have been going on through the pandemic, but also for the last few years. So, you know, if you go back pre-pandemic and really even after the great financial crisis, there were some policy decisions taken that we're essentially meant to keep interest rates low, bolster the asset prices. We've talked about that. You know, stocks went up, housing prices went up. But also part of that policy decision, and this was, you know, really driven by the labor left, was also to start raising wages at the kind of lower quarter of the socioeconomic spectrum. So the fight for 15, you remember, mm-hmm. you know, real activism around low-paying retail and service jobs. That was all part of this. And indeed, before the pandemic, you were starting to see a tightening of the labor market in those lower paying jobs. And you were even beginning to see certain retailers, you know, Starbucks duking it out with, you know, other chains to get the best service workers. So that was happening. Then you have the pandemic, everything falls off a cliff. And what's interesting in this country is, unlike some other countries where when things fall off a cliff, you see the state and the private sector and politicians and labor coming together to keep people in work, this country does it differently. We simply fire people, you know, we let them go. And but the downside of that is it creates these real boom bust cycles in the labor market where suddenly you have everybody that's, you know, has left work. Some people are getting stimulus payments that tied to them over for a certain yeah. time. But the companies then have to ramp back up once things start to boom, which, you know, looking around, they really are in many parts of the country now. You have to hire people from scratch. That takes time. It takes money. It creates these choke points, which is what you're seeing now. Companies, all of a sudden, all at once, need workers. That puts labor in a stronger position, and you see people taking advantage of that.
Okay, so we're going to talk in a few minutes about whether, given the arc that you just described, Rana and Michelle, whether this is going to settle down or if there are sort of deeper structural changes at work. But if you hang on here for a minute, I want to turn to a person who made this very decision, Jennifer Kostelic, who joins us from Portland, Maine. And in May, she quit her job. So, Jennifer, welcome to On Point. And what job did you have and why did you quit?
Hi, Magna. Hello. And I was a DSP, or a direct support professional, and I was working with developmentally and physically differently abled adults. Mm-hmm. It was in a group setting, so it was like an activity day program. And with the coronavirus, we were luckily able to switch all online. However, that translated into me teaching classes suddenly on Zoom, where we'd been like in a group, you know, like four of staff members in a room with 12 of our supported individuals, which is a very different feel from being the only person on a Zoom call mm-hmm. and you're teaching and out of my bedroom, which was not so easy for about almost a year and a half. That's what I was doing.
And so then what, I mean, a lot of people were doing something similar, yes. Jennifer. And so what about that made you reassess the work and led you to make the decision to leave that job?
So I was already becoming distressed over, you know, suddenly having such a shift in how the job actually played out. And just, man, I have CPTSD, which is PTSD that started in very early childhood.
Okay.
So I'm trying to manage my symptoms, my family, working, doing all this work now shifted online. I think I was making $14.50 an hour. And, you know, you have to do a lot of training. I have a degree as a teacher, so you can't just walk off the street. And it's not just an entry-level position. I had a issue with my supervisor. Mm-hmm. They know that I have PTSD, and we were having a meeting, and something came up, and I got triggered, and they responded badly. And I reminded them I have PTSD, and they were immediately yeah. like, oh, that's right, fine. I didn't stop being triggered, and then they cut back some of my hours mm-hmm. without even telling me. And I thought, well, I'll just look for another job, which I did immediately. After I get off the phone with you, I'm cleaning Airbnb apartments. So there's not a lot of meaning in the job, but the employer is paying me $50 every time I clean a room, and it takes me a little under an hour.
So you're going from under $15 an hour to $50 an hour potentially.
To $50 an hour, and I work 3 or 4 hours, 4 days a week. So I'm making almost the same amount of money, but what I'm getting is time. I am middle-aged. I am now menopausal. I am managing my mental illness. I've got kids headed to college. I've got a kid grad. So just having some time over the past year made it worth giving up the meaningful work. And I feel like that. Like, I think we've been fed a long story about finding work with meaning, which I think is important, but then be okay with it that you don't get paid much, or find work that doesn't have meaning, but you're really making a lot of money for someone else.
Jennifer, I was just going to jump in there and say that sigh that you gave us a second ago, I feel like there's an entire lifetime contained in that sigh. So you're describing a trade-off that you've had to make. I mean, does the diminution of meaning, I mean, how do you feel about having to make that trade-off?
It's very hard, and I actually called my legislators because there was a bill in trying to make its way through our legislature to pay home health care aides and health care workers more money, and the governor actually just signed it, like, day before yesterday. So I'm not sure how much the raises will be and how long it will take for that to happen, but I definitely don't have much meaning in my work, but it's like a job well done, and I don't have to deal with people. So for a little while, as one of your financial people said about her son, this is my job while I'm finding my job.
Okay.
But
so
the problem is it pays $50 an hour. So it's got to be really hard to replace.
Okay, so Jennifer, hang on here. I understand that you're calling for us from your car, getting ready for that next Airbnb cleaning that you have to do. So we're going to have to let you go in a few minutes. But I have to take a quick break.
Okay.
And I know you've got a question specifically for one of our muddy ladies, Michelle. So on the other side of that break, I'll let you ask that question and then let you get to your job. So hang on, everybody, here for a second. We are talking about why record numbers of Americans are leaving their work, 4 million in April alone. And what does that signify? So we'll talk more about it when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today we have our fabulous money ladies back with us, Rana Faruhar and Michelle Singletary, and we're talking about why record numbers of Americans are leaving their jobs and what's going on in the job market, whether this is a post-pandemic adjustment or signs of deeper changes when it comes to what Americans are looking for in their work. And we're also joined for a few more minutes before she has to get to her job, Jennifer Kostelic from Portland, Maine. And Jennifer, I know you had a specific question for Michelle in particular about sort of how to handle your finances during this time when you're doing this, your new work for cleaning Airbnbs.
Well, my question is actually specifically, I'm a Gen Xer, and I have a lot of Gen Xer friends that we just have almost no savings. Mm-hmm. My husband and I are lucky in that we have almost zero debt. However, we do not own our own home. We only own our own cars. And when we're looking at, you know, I'm 52, he's 50, what can we do now to make any kind of savings or something to invest towards our future when we have so little?
Well, first of all, you have quite a bit, right? You have each other. Yes. You have now work that doesn't stress you out. So I just want you to reframe the question. And the fact that you don't own a home doesn't make you a failure, because you kind of asked it like that. You talked about it in that sense. You are not a financial failure if you're renting. It's quite smart for you right now where you are. I would suggest, and I love that you don't have any debt. You know, everybody who knows me is like, yeah, I'm jumping up and down about that.
What are you going to say now, Michelle? There's no debt to talk about.
So what I would say that is that you do need to get on board in terms of retirement savings. I would be very, the two things I'm very concerned about. So with whatever you're earning, for first of all, make sure you get in touch with a good tax professional so you're making your estimated tax payments on that income, and that you don't get in trouble with the IRS with that. And then try to figure out as best you can money that you can carve out of that to start putting into a Roth IRA if you qualify, or a traditional IRA, so you can start building money towards your retirement. And I know you, I think you mentioned you have children. I didn't hear how old they were and how close they are to going to college.
Two Jennifer, are in college, there? And this, yes, are you there? Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Okay. Uh-huh. This has actually been the benefit of the mental, or the illness and the not being wealthy. Two of our three kids are in college, and they have amazing grants. So that they will,
wonderful.
They have student loans, and they've been given a lot of money from the colleges. So just one to graduate.
Okay, so that's great. So just try to minimize that amount of student loan debt. If you got one who's going, think about, you know, community college and going close to home. If you have the two that are in college and they're on campus and they can live at home, I would suggest that to cut the amount that they're borrowing, and that if you end up having to borrow for them. But I would say most importantly, both you and your husband need to get on track for retirement spending, and whatever that is. I mean, obviously, I would tell you as much as possible, but realistically, just do what you can. Mm-hmm. You're getting really close to that period where you might be able to work till you're 70 or 80. You may not be able to. And you'll realize that Social Security isn't going to cover as much as you need. So, so just really make that a priority.
Yeah. Well, Jennifer,
thank you so much.
Yeah. And thank you,
You're
Jennifer,
welcome.
For being with us, because I know you've got to go here in just a couple of minutes to that new job. And thank you for taking the time out to call us from your car as you wait to get to work here. So Jennifer Kostelic, joining us from Portland, Maine. Thank you so much, Jennifer.
Sure. Thanks. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Okay, so Michelle and Rana, I am officially deputizing myself to be kind of the Debbie Downer here of this hour, because I actually think Jennifer's story brings up a lot of core problems, which I don't see having changed at all for American workers. So therefore, if they're feeling a sense of optimism in leaving their work, is that optimism justified? First of all, we just talked about the fact that Jennifer doesn't really yet feel like she has any meaningful retirement savings. No big change in that across the United States. You know, she talked about she was a well-qualified worker, you know, qualified as a teacher, but in her job working with adults with special needs, she wasn't even making $15 an hour. So let's touch on that one, Rana, because you had mentioned that there was this movement pre-pandemic for wage increases, but we haven't. I mean, look, it's not coming from the federal government so far. We haven't really seen, we haven't seen that movement make any meaningful changes in the lives of millions of workers yet.
Well, that's entirely right. And there's really two trends. There's a short-term trend and there's a longer-term trend. And when I said there was movement at the lower end of the spectrum, which, you know, God knows was much needed, you know, because the idea of making a living on $15 an hour is just incomprehensible. So I like the fact that you're seeing wage pressure at the lower end. Just as a quick note, 34% of unemployment right now is people quitting their jobs because they feel confident in finding other jobs. So that's one of the things about the June report that I really like. But to go back to your point, yes, there is still a huge bifurcation. So you might have people who previously would have made $15 an hour or $12 an hour being able to get $21 an hour or, you know, $50 an hour in the case of the caller. Although, to be honest, let's look at that and say, how many houses can she clean? Can she clean mm-hmm. for 8 or 10 hours a day? I'll just tell you one personal story. When the pandemic hit and we were unable to have anybody in the house and my normal lady who helps us cleaning couldn't come, my husband and I said, okay, well, she comes once a week and cleans for 10 hours a day. We're going to divide that between the four of us in our household. We're going to do this, no problem. After about 3 hours, we all collapsed, exhausted, and I was thinking about how much of a raise I can give her when she comes back, because these are hard jobs. It's not like you're going to be able to work 10, you know, hours a day, 7 days a week doing this. So the wage is really, you have to look at it in that context. You see bifurcation.
Can I just jump in here for a quick second? Because the thing related to wages, and this that's really actually resonating with a lot of our listeners right now. For example, Amy Lakin just sent us a message on Twitter saying, yes, I totally agree. I never thought about meaningful work in that way. You're right. Mm. It's okay for us to give up meaningful work for better paid work in order to feel rested and compensated appropriately. I mean, Michelle, you heard Jennifer talk about workers having been fed, in her words, a long story about having meaningful work but getting barely paid for it. And she was just fed up with that story. Is that part of what's driving this? Because we're hearing from so many people that, like, they're just tired of being disrespected, tired of barely making ends meet.
I'm definitely hearing that from quite a few people. The folks, even in my home, I have a daughter studying to be a teacher, and I have a daughter who just graduated from a master's program and is a social worker therapist and not getting paid a whole bunch of money, which is why she's living at home. And so absolutely, we have, in a way, sold people a bill of goods. You know, get out there, pay all that money, get a college education at any cost, go into debt, you know, broker your future. And then they get out there and go, wait a minute, you aren't paying me what I'm worth. I got to work like a dog. And I just hold up. This is not happening for me. And I hopefully that will translate into better paying jobs with benefits and or a system in which, for example, healthcare isn't tied to your job.
Right.
The thing that worries me about Jennifer, which is what Ronna was saying, is that even if she could, you know, clean enough houses, you know, at any moment that money could go away because it's so temporary. And so, you know, you're obligating your household for different bills and things based on this income that's not stable. And that's the problem. And so you've got to work it both ways, which is why, you know, we talked about on this program all the time, ways to mitigate that is, for example, multi-generational housing and shared housing so that if somebody in the house is unemployed or has some employment issues, everything doesn't go. And I think because of disaster, right?
That is an amazing point. I just want to pick up on Michelle's housing point because I think that this speaks to this larger cultural shift that is underway. I mean, my daughter, who's almost 19, is assuming when she graduates from school that she will live in communal housing. There's a lot of, you know, younger people are, they're not assuming, I get out of school, I get my own apartment, I'm going to do things the way my parents or their parents did. There's a lot of shifts going on, not only in lifestyle, but just in terms of sharing of burden. I mean, if the public sector in this country is not going to give us a social safety net, we're going to create one together. I think that's really kind of amazing and heartening.
Okay, so the link there between people's individual, what they think their future prospects are and national level policy, that's something that Andrea, who works at a Hispanic media station in Ohio, called to tell us about. And here's why she's thinking about quitting.
One of the reasons why I want to quit my job is because it's not well paid. And most of the jobs in the U.S. are not well paid. And the way the wage is set is so that even working a full-time job, people would still live under the poverty line. And I've seen other countries where someone who's a gardener or someone who's, you know, works in a profession where it requires a specific set of skills, not necessarily something that has to do with academia or something. And I've seen those countries pay everyone really well. I mean, it's not, they're not, you know, millionaires, but everyone gets to have like a certain standard of living.
Rana, what do you think about that?
Oh, 100%. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this idea of balance, you know, I mean, I was thinking about this point that the previous caller made about meaningful work and giving up meaningful work just to feel rested. Well, you know, it's not as if meaning only has to come from work. You know, in other countries like Europe, for example, they actually think that life has meaning. And it's not, and it's interesting because it kind of plays into our bootstrapping mentality in this country and our sort of you are what you do mentality. I mean, our actions are who we are, but we have a lot of actions that don't have to do with our paid jobs, you know? And I think that bringing those two concepts together is really important. Just on that score too, we should talk a little bit about the caring economy, because that is where the job growth is going to be. Healthcare, childcare, education. These are things that are terribly paid right now, but that's where the growth is. A lot of that work is unpaid. It needs to be paid. It needs to be valued.
Well, I mean, Jennifer, who we heard from a few minutes ago, was literally in that caring economy, right? I mean, she was working with adults with special needs. And per your point, Rana, she left because she wasn't getting paid enough.
I know. It's absurd, but more than half of the job growth is going to come from those areas. And, you know, I have to say, I like what the Biden administration is doing on this front, you know, trying to create unionized work in the caring economy, in the infrastructure bill, supporting the SEIU, which is a unionized service union. You know, that's really important.
Well,
and on that point, if I just
sure.
add, the growth is in long-term care, and those jobs are not well paid. But we all know that at some point, a great percentage of our population is going to need some sort of long-term care. And it's very expensive, even though the people working in the industry aren't getting a lot of money. And that goes back to policy, so that if people don't have to pay for health care, they don't have to worry about sending their kids to college, there's affordable housing, even if we don't raise those salaries to say $50 or $100 an hour, which they absolutely deserve, at least there won't be so much demand on the money that they are earning.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to talk more about sort of what workers want, what's causing them to quit and look for other jobs here. But I want to also explore for a second whether or not you both think that that is going to actually create meaningful pressure on employers to change not just temporary practices or temporary wages, but, you know, fundamental changes to the kind of work they're offering, how people are compensated and treated as well. Because one place we're really seeing a big impact right now is in the restaurant sector. This is Jeff Lucas. He's a general manager of a restaurant in Pittsburgh, and he says he is witnessing massive changes.
It's a shame because I love this industry. But unfortunately, I feel like our industry was cast aside, and there's now literally a caste system in this country. People that work in quote-unquote educated environments were treated with respect and dignity, and their financial concerns and their safety were considered. And people in our service industry were treated like servants. We were forced to either work under the conditions, whatever those conditions might have been, with no regard for our safety, and supports both the financial owners of our companies and also cater to people that may or may not have shown any respect to any of the policies or practices that were out there to keep people safe.
So that's Jeff, a restaurant manager in Pittsburgh, and he also told us he's currently looking for job opportunities outside of the restaurant industry. So, Michelle, let me quickly turn to you. Look, the restaurant industry has got a lot of, you know, small business owners who are trying to keep their heads above water. It's also got massive corporate ownership of restaurants as well. So I'm not going to paint them all with the same brush. But do you think that, you know, what Jeff is saying could actually produce some kind of change in how workers are treated?
I think he was so spot on. And honestly, I'm being pessimistic right now. Absolutely not. I mean, just look at the commentary about unemployment benefits and the signs that restaurant people were putting on their door. I can't get nobody. They too lazy working at home trying to get unemployment. I mean, that tells you right there they don't respect those workers. And the commentary, let's just be honest, from the conservative side, you know, is that, you know, they're lazy. They don't want want to work, and we got to take benefits away from them to force them into these jobs. And what he was saying is that, you know, in all different states, we know for a fact that people are not wearing their masks. They're not getting vaccinated. And you want these people to come to work and serve you? Absolutely quit and go find a different job. Eat your hamburger at home. I mean, it's just ridiculous, the commentary out there. So I really don't think it's going to move fast enough, which is why we have to have the government make them. I mean, look at the edicts to come back to work. We spent, what is it now, a year and a half almost, working from home, those who could work from home. And we did it well, and we did our work. We weren't sitting on the couch watching Ellen all day. And they're like, you got to come back into this office. Why? We know, especially in large metropolitan areas, the commute is stressful. It's stressful for you. It's stressful when your kids. You know, I've worked from home, thankfully, for most of my career now at the Washington Post, because I had some illnesses. My children had asthma. And I, you know, thankfully had a boss. I said, listen, I'm not doing this anymore. I got to go get my kid half the time because they're having an asthma attack. And, you know, because I was so close to their school, I could go get them and still do my work.
Yeah.
And so the answer to your question is, I have no confidence that the majority of employers will do the right thing when it comes to their workers.
Yeah, well, you know, Rana Michelle is behind the wheel and she's driving this car right now. but we'll take a quick break and I will get your take on this. And then I really want to explore with both of you how we what measures we should look for the kinds of changes that could come with this mass resignation that we're seeing right now. So we'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are listening to our favorite money ladies, Michelle Singletary, personal finance columnist for The Washington Post and author of What to Do with Your Money When Crisis Hits, a survival guide. And Rana Farouhar is with us as well, Financial Times global business columnist and associate editor there, author of, most recently, Don't Be Evil. And Rana and Michelle, so many people have things to say about this question of why they're leaving work. Citizen Chip has been telling us, pay people what they're worth and they'll work for you. Simple as that. BD Sensei says, spot on, a job with meaning should not equate to low pay. Examples, firemen, police, teachers, social workers, etc. These are different jobs. I'm going to keep going here for a second. Georgette Arado says, coronavirus basically highlighted all of the things that were already wrong. It was like the final slap in the face that made me wake up and realize my career would never move forward if I stayed where I was. Maureen O'Keefe, my priorities change during the pandemic. Aaron Johnson also has a story about an elderly customer had an accident in my place of work. I cleaned it up with speed and safety. I was getting paid the state minimum. I asked for a raise and they said, we don't do raises. Thanks, though. There's no respect out there, just corporations working their numbers and playing with human lives. Rana, your take on that?
Wow. Well, there's a lot there. You know, just in terms of what we're going to see longer term coming out of this, pandemics are major events. They always shift economies in structural ways. This is going to be no exception to that. One of the things I am a little concerned about, even though you've seen this strong hiring in the service sector and restaurants, care work, there's a lot of service jobs that can be done digitally. So go into a restaurant these days, sit down at a bar. You're not ordering from a service person generally. You're ordering from a little computer, a little tablet that's propped up on your chair. that kind of digital job displacement is going to really ramp up. In fact, we're seeing some figures showing it's probably going to be double in terms of what companies are going to spend to try and replace jobs with technology, software, et cetera, to replace humans with technology. It's going to be double what it was in the aftermath of the great financial crisis. So how do you get ahead of that? You get ahead of that with education and retraining, which goes to this point about jobs in the caring economy. They're undervalued right now, but they're going to be the fastest growing jobs. I think that that is going to increase wage pressure. I think that that's going to mean that you are going to finally start to see teachers, trainers, you know, people that are helping others bolster their skills become more valued. It has to happen. Otherwise, the U.S. economy as a whole is not going to be able to grow. Now, how it's going to happen, whether we're going to see some kind of concerted effort at a national level or whether we're going to see these things just bubbling up locally, I don't know yet. But that's what has to happen. It's the only way forward.
Okay, so let me just follow up on that. Yeah. Because focusing on wages here, in the past, we have seen wages rise due to at least one of let me say three factors. One is an increase in minimum wages, whether at the state or federal level.
Yeah.
Two is union organizing, right? Or an empowered labor sector. Three is the one you just pointed to, that there is a demand amongst employers. They need qualified workers. They have to attract them somehow. Wages are one tool for that. Okay, so maybe the third one's going to come to pass. The first one isn't. And the second one, which has historically been very, very important, organized labor, that still isn't roaring back with any, to the degree that it was in past generations where we saw really systemic changes in the labor market.
Well, yes, and that's because the labor movement itself is evolving. I mean, if you look at the traditional labor movement, it is still, it's political. It's still geared a lot around older line manufacturing jobs and trying to preserve work as it once was. But there is, you know, there are new movements, the freelancers union, service workers unions. These are starting to take effect, and they're also getting, they're being bolstered by the administration. I see one important trend here that you didn't name, though, and that's the fact that the caring economy, healthcare, education, childcare, these cannot be outsourced. Think about what happened to labor in the last 40 years. A lot of jobs were replaced by technology. A lot of them were outsourced. Mm-hmm. High touch work, it's much harder to outsource it. I'm not saying that you can. I mean, telemedicine would be one thing you could potentially outsource. You know, there's a lot of very qualified Indian doctors that could probably diagnose you for a third of what an American could. But the majority of work in a hospital, in an elder care facility, in a child care center, in a school, these cannot be outsourced. They cannot be done by technology. That's a real leg up for people working in those jobs.
Yeah, but we're asking people to do it for $15 or less an hour. And, I'm getting overexcited here. but this is bringing the question of childcare is bringing together a bunch of different issues regarding work and family life in America. And so, Michelle, I'm going to throw this one to you because we know that in the past year, when we're talking about a recession, it was a she session, right? Millions of women having to leave their jobs, whether they were let go or had to leave because of childcare issues, for example. We know, and Rana's exactly right about this. For at least the time being, we're not going to get AI. We don't want AI to be our highly qualified child carers, but we still. If we want high quality childcare, it costs a lot, and those very families who need that aren't making enough to pay for it. So there's still this vicious cycle that's trapping American families from both doing the work that they want and need and getting the care for their kids. And I still don't see the way out of that trap.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the problems is the people, as you just said, that need the care. It's not as if they don't want to pay someone what they deserve to take care of their kid. They themselves are not making a lot of money. And the money they are making is is at what's the word I'm looking for? Is there's such a demand on their paycheck for health care and food and putting a roof over their heads. If you live in a major metropolitan area, you're more likely spending about 40 to 50, sometimes as much as 60% of your take-home pay on housing. That's not sustainable. Yeah. And that doesn't lend itself to increase the wages for the person taking care of your kid. And so we've got to we have to work in tandem to make this happen. So it's not just wages. It's got to be all these other things as well. Healthcare, housing, all of those things that make people broke, and to be honest. And then on the other side, we never really talk about this, but consumers, those of us who are making good money, because there are, you know, middle America making some pretty decent money, we have to be able to not be so cheap. And this is coming from some person who's very frugal. We want, you know, a $2 shirt. We want a, you know, 50 cents hamburger, you know, and we're not thinking about the people who have to make that and give it and sell it to us. And so lots of times employers push back on wages, they say, because their customers won't allow them to raise, you know, prices up to a certain point. And so we, us, those who can afford it, have to say, I'm willing to pay you $20 to $30 or $40 an hour to take care of my mom.
Oh, Michelle, about to be like, well, what about the whole issue of shareholder value and the money going that direction?
That's true too. And you know, I'm not an economist and I can't answer that question too. But you know, but the fact of the matter is, you know, there are a lot of things that we can go without and we have these just unbelievable demands on what we should get back for our money. And part of that is because we want to make more money so we can have security. Yeah. So it's like a vicious cycle, right?
Right. Rana, go ahead. Yeah, Rana, go ahead.
Yeah. I actually think Michelle's pointing out all the important stuff, and I think change is coming. Here's why. The shareholder value pressures, which we've talked about on this show before, the idea that companies are under pressure to cut costs, to cut their balance sheets, you know, to outsource labor, that's true. But incentives can change. There is a conversation right now happening in the administration and within the SEC about changing the reporting requirements for companies to reflect environmental, social, and governance concerns, labor concerns. That's coming down the pike. If that happens, then everything changes. Let me give you an example. If you were a company and you really had to show on your balance sheet in a clear way, the same way that, you know, if you go into a grocery store, you can see the calories and fat counts on the back of a product, which, by the way, made a huge change in people's purchasing habits when that happened. If you could see, gosh, if I'm going to go into Walmart and buy this t-shirt for $10, but I'm going to be able to see on that t-shirt the cost of the carbon emissions that it took to ship it from China, the fact that there was, you know, child labor or it didn't meet certain labor and environmental standards, that starts to shift things. Then add on the burden, a regulatory burden for companies or fines for not meeting certain standards, or the fiduciary responsibilities of investment houses that are holding those shares. All of those things can be put in play to change the way we purchase things. That is coming down the pike. Mm. And I'll say one more thing about Michelle's point to the things that make us middle class: housing, healthcare, pensions. That's where all the inflation has been over the last 20 years. But the housing piece is about to change profoundly because the pandemic and work from home, which is not going away. We're seeing pushback in some areas, but it's not going away. There's going to be, I think, a 30% shift at least in the footprint of commercial real estate and offices, and people are going to be able to live in cheaper cities and do the work that they were doing in the more expensive cities where they were paying 60% for housing. Now they're either going to pay 30% or they're going to live communally. That's going to be a big shift.
Okay, so since we did touch on the corporate labor market, let's just get the voice of another listener in here really quickly. This is Joe Frederick from Buffalo, New York, and this is why he quit his job.
Corporate culture thing can be kind of more taxing on us, where there's an expectation that being required to be smiling and happy all the time and giving us donuts and cider on Halloween does not, in fact, make us as happy as we are when we're with our friends and family and doing things we actually want to do. So it isn't fulfilling their function, which is to make for happy workers. In fact, it's just one more thing to do that is an effort.
Joe, I hear you, and I would extend it from donuts and cider at Halloween to Zoom happy hours, but that's just me. Now, listen, we've got 5 minutes left here, and I've got one numbers-based question, and then I want to sort of get both of you to help give us some tools on how we should try to meaningfully measure change when it comes to work in America over the next couple of years. But the numbers question that I have, Rana, is you mentioned that June jobs report, and I have mm-hmm. a very, very strong allergy to making any conclusions off 1 month's jobs reports, right? Like, because it's out of context from the bigger trends in the economy. And I don't like that administrations take credit or issue blame based on one jobs report.
Of course.
So we've got the 850,000 jobs added in June. Good number. But there's still a big gap from what the number of jobs or workers that we had in February of 2020 before the pandemic. Yep. That 6 million gap. Should we be concerned about that?
No. And I'll tell you why. If things were moving even faster than they are now, or if the administration were throwing more fuel on the fire, that could actually overheat the economy and create inflationary pressures that couldn't be managed well. That's something that's a fear that you've heard from certainly from the conservatives and certain parts of the more corporatist wing of the Democratic Party. Oh my God, inflation's going to overheat. We can't we can't pay people more. We've got to keep costs under control. One thing I really liked about the June report is you saw some uptick in wages, but it wasn't runaway. I don't think that we are going to see the kind of inflationary pressures that are longer term that could derail the recovery. I still think that any short-term pressures we see are going to be counterbalanced by this incredibly disinflationary effect of technology. And that's why we've got to focus on training to get people to be more productive, able to use the technology to harness those wage gains for themselves in new jobs.
Okay. So the last couple of minutes here, I really value your wisdom from the both of you here. And we've talked about sort of broad swaths of every aspect of modern American life and how that flows through how people see their jobs and what they want from work and compensation and everything. So I'm wondering, do you think right now, perhaps the pandemic, a silver lining to this terrible experience, has provided the country with some building blocks for meaningful change when it comes to work in this country? And what would you like to see happen, let's say, in the next couple of years? We've just got 2 minutes left. So, Michelle, I'll ask you first.
I do think there is a silver lining. I think that we all realized how interconnected we were to each other. And I think long before the pandemic, we were like, and Rana talked about that bootstrapping mentality that I got what I got on my own. And we now realize that we need workers. We need teachers. We need people to take care of our children and our mom while we work. And so I'm glad in a sense that we understood that the pandemic made us realize that we need each other and that when you're lifted, I'm lifted. Mm-hmm. And I just hope that we remember that as we come out of this, that what happens to that teacher matters to you, if nothing else, to your retirement portfolio as well. And so I am confident about that. And just, I know you don't have a lot of, but I've been talking to all the young adults who maybe went home and gave up their apartment, stay there. And I hope the commentary that if you're living with a relative or your parents in your 30s that somehow you're a failure, I just pray that changes. I think it's terrific. I think it's smart. And I told my daughter, if she meets somebody living at home, good for you. He's smart. Marry him.
Rana, you get the last minute today.
Okay. Well, I completely agree. And I would just say, I do think we're at a pivot point. I think we're in what I would call the post-neoliberal world. The last 40 years have been about corporate profits, about cutting costs, about devaluing human capital. Guess what? Human capital is the only thing that matters in the digital economy because it's all about what's in your head, what's in your heart. It's about caring, and it's about intelligence. It's about what people can do. And in order to stay ahead of the machines, we've got to start valuing that. So I do think that's coming down the pike.
Yeah. Well, in my sort of pedantic, structure-minded minded head, I'm going to say I want to see changes in retirement security, healthcare, wages, housing, and education for Americans in the next 2 years. So a tall order, but that's what we do here at On Point. Rana Faruhar, Financial Times global columnist and also with CNN as well, and author of Don't Be Evil. Thank you as always, Rana. So great to talk with you.
Thanks for having me.
And Michelle Singletary, nationally syndicated columnist with The Washington Post and author of What to Do with Your Money When Crisis Hits. Michelle, a joy, as always. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. And I didn't cry this time. Almost.
We'll do it next time. Ron and Michelle are our money ladies. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken? Wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.